Well, I intend to do that by keeping with our subject of our speaker today, and I'm going to make my own personal report on feminism and Mormonism. This subject arises because the conference was co-chaired by one male and one female. And did we share the responsibility, therefore, and the honors equally and equitably? Interestingly, we had more than one phone inquiry about our standing as feminists. Now, not one person called to inquire about our standing as intellectuals. And it was perhaps the answer to that question was obvious in one way or the other. And I mentioned this phenomena of checking out our feminist credentials to a person whose judgment I value, who said that I had been married for 40 years to the same uppity woman, and that should establish at least my credentials. I accepted that assessment, but realized that the matter of first billing in the styling of ourselves as co-chairs might be a very sensitive issue. Should we be Robert and Sharon Larson co-persons, co-chairpersons, or Sharon and Robert Larson co-chairpersons? What were the implications of either of these stylings? The solution was arrived. We varied the billing more or less at random. And whichever way it went, we signed the letter in the opposite direction. Apparently, this worked very well, as no one called to complain, or perhaps even noticed, but our credentials go unscathed. I would present to you Lori Winder Stromberg, who will introduce our speaker for this afternoon, Cecilia Concher Farr.
Well, I have the privilege of introducing Cecilia this afternoon. While knowing that Cecilia was a seventh grade chess champion, that she once considered joining a mountain bike group called Babes on Bikes, and that she tested the boundaries of academic freedom as an assistant professor at BYU are all equally compelling. What many of us appreciate most about Cecilia is that she is a woman who embraces Mormonism and feminism and compromises on neither. Fortunately, in her present position as an assistant professor of English at the College of St. Catherine, a women's college in Minnesota, religion and feminism are no longer, the compromises surrounding religion and feminism are no longer expected of her. The title of Cecilia's paper today is Taking It Personally, Feminism and Mormonism in Our Lives. Cecilia.
There's an appropriate time in this paper that this angelic choir I hear over there, if they would start singing, it would be just right. There's so much I want to talk to you about, and there are probably some questions that you have that I'm going to leave some time at the end of the paper to let you feel free to ask me anything you want. So if I fail to answer the pertinent questions for you, just raise your hand and I'll ask them later. I steal my title for this talk from the title of a book I'm working on called Taking It Personally, Feminist Education and Academic Freedom, which is one of those now oh-so-popular minglings of the autobiographical and the theoretical. In it, I reflect on my experience as an English professor at BYU and expand out from there to what it means to be a feminist educator in the age of Newt Gingrich. In some ways, I feel privileged to have experienced BYU, which is, as we say in literary studies, like the rest of the academy writ large with respect to attitudes about feminism. But I figure it's okay to steal the title since I'm also robbing from the book to give this presentation to you today, which is sort of a plug for the book, which is kind of a nasty thing to do. It's not written yet, so you can't even buy it, so forget it. Let me start by describing three separate incidents that have for me, come to characterize BYU. Scene one. a rather spacious office in the Ernest L. Wilkinson Center, circa 1986. It is the second year of my master's program in literature, and I have come to define myself clearly and rather passionately as a feminist critic. So, like most impatient converts, I am eager to get on with the business of changing the world right now. When BYU student government announces that it must replace the young woman who was to head the women's office for them due to her untimely marriage, I hear angels singing. Here, this is the part. Sing, angels. Here's a chance for me to bloom where I am planted. Sure, student government at BYU was and is a joke, with no autonomy and no real power, but here was a chance to help them to get serious, to focus on women students and our needs. I draw up a plan. Child care, violence prevention and education, academic advising, mentoring, scholarships, and I head for the interview. I walk in, a 27-year-old former newspaper reporter, working-class Pittsburgher, classic oldest daughter overachiever, and a Mormon with a mission call. I'm wearing, 80s style, a power suit and pumps. I am formidable. I confront two young men in identical khakis, blue Oxford shirts, navy blazers, and loafers. I don't know if any of you remember the segment on David Letterman, What's Hal Wearing? That's what they look like. They were wearing what Hal Gurney wears. Their hair is too short. Their ears stick out on either side of their shiny scrubbed faces. What is it about Mormon boys that they always have those big ears? Anyway. They invite me, no offense, Brian, that's why you grow your hair long, right? So no one would notice. They invite me to sit down, and moving behind a massive desk, they rustle some papers importantly and explain that they are the student government president and vice president. Something about them makes me think of Tweedledum and Tweedledee. Elders Tweedledum and Tweedledee. They look me up and down. They are clearly unimpressed. Why, they ask, do you want to be in student government? I hear, why do you want to be in student government? I begin to explain the importance of paying attention to women's issues, of focusing on the needs of women students and bringing up our embarrassingly low graduation rate. I cite statistics and begin to launch into my plan when the vice president stops me. Thank you, he says. Now, could you tell us how you would handle ticket sales for preference? I hesitate. Ticket sales. I stare blankly. He explains that the crowds are unmanageable for this twice annual event when BYU women are given special dispensation to invite men out on dates. The lines at the Marriott Center, the competition for prime locations. I stammer and stutter, trying to formulate a reply. The president breaks in, explaining, matter-of-factly, that the chief function of the women's office is to sponsor preference. I interrupt and continue to talk about the need to address childcare, violence prevention and education, academic advising, mentoring. They smile and nod, then explain that they have pulled off a coup and are getting Neil Diamond or Hall & Oates or America to perform at the preference concert. So the lines are going to be especially bad. They are earnest. They are smiling. They are clueless. How do you think you might handle distribution? Maybe by wards, I offer lamely. Scene 2, another office. This one a bit smaller and shabbier, more cluttered, but with light streaming in through the first floor windows. I notice the sunlight because my tiny office on the third floor has none, and my plants are dying. It is 1992, and I am back at BYU, PhD in hand, a grown-up scholar, an Americanist, and a feminist theorist. I was invited to this office by a linguistics professor who had, in a paper he shared with some of my students, accused feminists of having an us and them mentality. So, he concluded, they don't belong in a university where we, by our very nature, are more broad-minded than that. You're telling me that I have no right to criticize feminists because I am not a feminist? PC lights going off all over his red face. Are you saying that since I hold the priesthood, I can't offer my scholarly opinion about feminism? No, I attempt again, wondering how scholarly it is to compare academic feminists to Nazis and the Khmer Rouge. I'm just trying to say that you should consider how your authority as a priesthood holder in this community adds currency to your opinions that they wouldn't have in any other setting. I'm asking you to be more careful about how you describe feminists, some of whom are your colleagues, to your students who honor your ecclesiastical authority. So, in other words, you think I have no right to criticize feminism because I am a man and I hold the priesthood. "Why can't he hear me?" I scream inside my head, phrases from his paper ringing in my ears. I think of his comparison of social injustices against women to earthquake, lightning, and other acts, or car wrecks, and other acts of God that we should accept by turning the other cheek. I remember his premise that feminism is antithetical to the university, and I know that I'm getting nowhere. I feel like I was hit head-on by a maliciously bad driver. I move toward the door, fighting back tears of anger and pain. He moves toward me to shake my hand and leveling his voice to thank me for coming. And I realize at that moment that he couldn't hear me because he never saw me. Later, when he misrepresents our meeting to administrators and colleagues in memo after memo, I type up the following clarification to the academic vice president. I never send it. I did not say he could not critique feminism. I said he wasn't critiquing feminism. I distinguished for him what I saw as charitable critique, looking for the flaws or contradictions in a system of thought in order to change it for the better, and what I perceived his attitude to be, malicious undermining with a goal towards silencing or destroying a system of thought, i.e. getting feminism out of our university. Though it is uncharitable of me to say so, it was a mistake to talk to him at all. He was determined to misunderstand me because understanding me or encountering feminism in any positive way would have thwarted his thesis. He freely admits to never having studied feminism. His research for the article consists of one obscure citation from the Rocky Mountain MLA Journal, a couple of Daily Universe letters to the editor, and a quote copied from off my door. Of course I was very angry when I spoke with him, I pounded out on my computer keyboard. I felt very much like Ralph Ellison's Invisible Man. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me, Ellison writes. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination, indeed everything and anything except me. When someone assumes they already know you, they can't see in you anything but what they expect. I have had this encounter too many times since I quit trying to hide the big red F on my chest. Because I am a feminist scholar, and I find it important morally and politically to say so, I am often only a screen for close-minded people to project their prefabricated images onto. This has been the most consistent part of my experience at BYU. Those who oppose me never speak to me. They speak about me. Indeed, they speak only about their images of me. Scene 3. This is by far the finest office yet. Top floor of the Smoot Building. Top-notch furnishings, leather, and dark, rich wood. I am facing the university president and his two top administrators, though my request was simply to visit with the president. It is 1993, and I don't know it yet, but I'm about to be fired. They have known for months, but of course they're not telling me. I should probably also mention they don't tell me in this meeting. Somebody later sticks a note under my office door to let me know I'm fired. But right now, with rumors flying all over the university, I'm trying to let these men know me and not images of me. No, that's what I meant to do. What I find myself doing now is trying to find out what I need to do to please these men. I honestly ask them how they want me to change. I am crying. One sits across from me near the door, turned away from me in his chair, his arms and legs crossed. He refuses to meet my gaze. I try to engage him in conversation. Another sits opposite him on the other side of the room. He and I have been friends. We have laughed and shared stories, borne testimony to each other. Today, he doesn't know me. He scolds and admonishes. He is a patriarch. The third, the president, takes a seat next to me and at one point offers me a box of Kleenex off his desk. He looks at me. He appears to listen. I focus on him desperately. To him, I feel, I am real. I am human. In the end, he assures me that he understands, that he is on my side. But still, I leave utterly humiliated, determined, as I said to a friend, never again to have to justify my existence before a tribunal of men. I go home, hold my infant son to my cheek, and sob. The next time I visit them, I bring an attorney. For me, these three scenarios are representative of my experience at BYU. There are zillions more like them. But they are also representative in a broader sense of my experience as a woman in the church and in the academy. They represent the three most crushing weapons that have been ranged against me as a woman: trivialization, invisibility, or what legal theorist Patricia Williams calls ignorance, and powerlessness. The unique thing about experiencing these at BYU is that there the veneer of politeness that naturalizes and disguises their cruelty was thin. Their teeth showed through, and looking closely, I saw the monsters lurking in the shadows. But who were the monsters, and what made them monstrous? It would be easy to blame the church hierarchy wherein the order to fire me originated, or the BYU administration which delivered the deception, or those few colleagues who snapped to and did the dirty work. But as I explained at Sunstone in August, none of these explanations was entirely satisfactory to me. I knew these men who did cruel things, and they were, for the most part, good men. Let me skip forward and take you to a department meeting last fall where about 15 of us from the English department at College of St. Catherine had gathered in the living room of one of our colleagues to hear a noted lecturer on autobiographical writing. She led us through an exercise in which we had to close our eyes and visualize an encounter with a literary figure. Now, as my friends here know, I'm not much of a New Age gal. I don't visualize or do guided imagery. I don't believe in Chinese herbs or crystals. I don't practice alternative medicine, and please don't talk to me about our nurturing Mother Earth. But my idea of healing is waiting until my wounds stop bleeding before I get back on my mountain bike to try that move again. Nevertheless, being new in the department, I felt obligated to play nice. So I closed my eyes. But just to be contrary, I conjured up the poet John Milton. Here is what I wrote afterwards. It is Milton. No, it's God, Moses, Orrin Hatch, and Rex Lee. Now there's a combination. He keeps changing shapes, changing suits. He has trouble seeing me and hearing me. Now this is one of those free writing activities where you're just supposed to spit out what you just felt. We met in the library at Dartmouth College. There are old books all around us. I can smell them. We are encased in tradition. Tea at 4. I am sitting in a dark green leather armchair, brass tacks on the arm that I trace with my finger. Milton strides in. He surveys the room and doesn't see me. I stand up and go to him. I ask him if I can see his book. It is Paradise Lost, old, yellowed, like the manuscript Orlando finally turns over to her publisher. He hands it to me, still looking around and through me. I raise my voice and ask him if he knows that women, too, are divine, that indeed we are human. Can you see me, I ask him. He looks bemused. His brow wrinkles. Can you hear me? I know he wants me to do something for him, to give him directions or darn his socks or transcribe his manuscript, not to engage him. I am enraged. I retreat, or do I disappear? He crosses the library as if he knows exactly where he is going. I put down my pen and looked up. I was taken aback at what I had just written. Of course, I knew exactly where it came from, as nearly every Mormon woman in this room knows. But what I hadn't known was that I was so very angry. Why, I wondered, hadn't I conjured up a cheery encounter with Louisa May Alcott? Why had I pursued this encounter? And I had, taking 2 Milton courses in graduate school, though I specialize in 20th century women writers, and teaching at BYU when I had other job offers. When the lecturer asked us to explain why we chose the person we did, I wrote, "He became human for me by way of Stanley Fish in a seminar at Dartmouth College. How in fear I was that summer. That fear never leaves." That fear never leaves. Of course, I asked myself over and over since then what I'm so afraid of, and the simple answer is men in suits. The longer answer is about the way authority corrupts and about how many of us are slowly educated away from our humanity. We forget how to make each other human, to let one another live and grow. Arthur Parker Palmer posits that when students learn objective neutral knowledge and the importance of detached observations, a type of knowledge we code masculine, they learn that the world is an object to be manipulated and accommodated to their needs. Knowledge needs to go deeper, to examine how it works in relation, as the feminist theorists say, to show Carl's thesis defender that this is his kind of question. Palmer writes, "The failure of modern knowledge is not primarily a failure in our ethics, in the application of what we know. Rather, it is the failure of our knowing itself to recognize and reach for its deeper source and passion, to allow love to inform the relations that our knowledge creates with ourselves, with each other, with the whole animate and inanimate world." Patricia Williams illustrates this failure further in The Alchemy of Race and Rights when she describes the way exam questions operate in law schools. Often she explains the professors invent scenarios in which race or gender plays a central role, then invite students to consider the legal questions apart from issues of race or gender, to be objective, not subjective. They actually require the assumption of an impersonal but racist, sexist, homophobic mentality in order to do well in the grading process, she writes. This is how, over time, perfectly rational and humanitarian insights and concerns are devalued as a matter of habit rather than wisdom, as merely experiential and irrelevant to the law. Law professors can thus set up irresponsibly authoritarian constructs that give permission to and legitimize some really warped worldviews, she says. The result will be students who are cultured to hate, yet who still think of themselves as very, very good people, who will be deeply offended and personally hurt if anyone tries to tell them otherwise. Thus, the Mormon attorney in Angels in America can hold on to his self-image as a righteous person, asking his superiors not to swear in his presence, while he goes about destroying lives in the name of objective exercise of the law. Certainly, we are complex creatures living with a lot of self-deception, but here is a deception we must divest ourselves of. We can't forget that the reason all spiritual gifts are nothing without charity is because charity must motivate them all. Why prophesy except that you love and care for the people you prophesy to? Why move a mountain except to demonstrate not authority or power, but love? Why educate yourself except to make the world a better place? This is why I believe all authority and knowledge must be taken personally, a type of knowledge we have coded feminine. We must make it about persons, ourselves and others, and make it full of charity and eager to embrace difference. I see my biggest challenge as a teacher and professor of literature as very similar to my biggest challenge as a disciple of Christ, to love my students, my texts, my work. My biggest challenge as an angry ex-BYU professor is to accept the humanity of my detractors. Let me switch for a moment back to the other point at hand, why women have had to take it personally in the church when patriarchy fails to act charitably. I refuse to accept the stylish conservative characterization of victim feminist because I don't envision myself primarily as a victim. If I did, I wouldn't be a feminist. Why bother? But it is true that because of the configuration of the church, and for me, of the church university, women are more likely to suffer trivialization, invisibility, and powerlessness more often and more painfully than men who, from age 12, have a personal stake in the authority of the institution. To make plain the difference, I offer you this poem by Marge Piercy. It's called A Work of Artifice. The bonsai tree in the attractive pot could have grown 80 feet tall on the side of a mountain till split by lightning. But a gardener carefully pruned it. It is 9 inches high. Every day as he whittles back the branches, the gardener croons, "It is your nature to be small and cozy, domestic and weak. How lucky, little tree, to have a pot to grow in. With living creatures, one must begin very early to dwarf their growth. The bound feet, the crippled brain, the hair in curlers, the hands you love to touch." I can't begin to tell you how deeply this poem moves me. Most of you have heard me speak of my ardent commitment to feminist education. Now, I may be wrong, but I think it matters a lot whether you're the gardener or the tree. And although being Mormon has often been an empowering experience for me as a woman, it has also and all too often been limiting because I am a woman. I know from teaching and talking to and emailing my many Mormon friends that this is the case for more than a few of us. Obviously, this is not unique to Mormonism. It is present in American culture on a much larger scale. But my contention is that some church teachings, eternal progression, for example, or the parable of the talents, ought simply to be applied to women too. We must allow women complete humanity and access to divinity. This is my definition of feminism. Now, as all of us liberal Mormons and intellectuals search for ways to move forward in our knowledge, in our humanity, and in our community, let me offer this final thought in the spirit of my Catholic Women's College from St. Gregory. Love itself is knowledge. The more one loves, the more one knows. Let us lead out by taking our knowledge more personally and thereby avoiding as much as possible cruelty and dehumanization, trivialization and ignorance. As Parker Palmer writes, When we know something truly and well, that which we know does not feel like a separate object to be manipulated and mastered. Instead, we feel inwardly related to it. Knowing it means that we have somehow entered into its life and it into ours. When we change our relationship to knowledge and power, I honestly believe we are on our way to changing the world, or as I like to say, bringing about Zion. We may, however, have to give up on changing BYU. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, we do have time for, about how much time? Half an hour or so? For questions and answers. I began to compile a list, a la David Letterman, of the top 10 questions most asked Cecilia when she left BYU. Number 10, how much did how much did BYU have to fork out under the settlement agreement? Number 9. Well, I'll let you come up with the rest. So we have about a half an hour or so for questions.
You'll have to repeat the questions, I think.
Okay, since I've been asked not to comment on number 10, perhaps you can start with number 9. Yes?
How do you find the atmosphere of the Catholic?
The question is, how do you find the atmosphere of the Catholic? It's actually not a university, but a small Catholic women's college. And every time I read their mission statement, I just am so happy I am where I am. It's about, they talk about integrating women's spirituality and their education, their self-esteem, and their professional goals. They take women's education very seriously, and so it's a wonderful place for me to be right now. It's Catholic, not owned by the Catholic Church, but owned and run by the Sisters of St. Joseph, which is an order of nuns who mostly do healthcare things, battered women's shelters, rape crisis centers, and education. A lot of them are teachers. And the Catholic Church doesn't have much to do with nuns like these anymore. And they all signed a statement right after I got to St. Kate's that said that women should have access to the priesthood. Even the college president signed it, and they mailed it off to the Pope. So, I think the Catholics have more experience dealing with issues of academic freedom. A lot of us say that the Mormon Church is still in the Inquisition phase, and the Catholic Church has sort of grown beyond that. So it's very different, and in fact, it's a really nice fit for me professionally right now, and I really enjoy it. Yes?
If you did comment on number 10, what would happen? Would they take the money away, or have you already spent it?
If the question, which I have to repeat into the microphone, is that if I did comment on number 10, what would happen to the money, money that we're not even allowed to acknowledge is there? Or she says, have you already spent it? Let me tell you about my mountain bike. It's got front shocks, this wonderful frame. Kind of expensive. Yeah. Sue me. I guess they could sue me. It's part of the agreement. Yes?
I probably asked the wrong kind of question because everybody knows your background.
The question is what my educational background is, how I got to BYU. I'm from actually even worse than working class, a very poor family in the Pittsburgh area. My dad and grandparents and uncles and even my brother until recently were mill workers and Eastern European immigrants. And in the 70s and 80s was not the best time to have had that profession in Pittsburgh. The unemployment rate there at that time was usually up around 30%, which is what it was in the United States during the Great Depression. It was a very difficult time to be in Pittsburgh. And I guess in my working class community, the assumption I always say was that I would get married and live in a trailer court and raise a lot of children. And the assumption was most often, I mean, I didn't hear anything else from my guidance counselors, even though I had, you know, outstanding grades. And I never really heard anything else from people in the church who were all waiting for me to marry this perfect boy that had always been the one that I was supposed to marry. And something snapped when I was about 18. In fact, I had what was probably a nervous breakdown, only we don't do therapy in Pittsburgh. We just handle it. So, and then after that, I went to college, and college was just a miracle to me. Every day, I was so happy to wake up in the morning and go to another class. It's just this amazing, transforming experience. And I was the first person in my family to get a bachelor's degree. No one else has a bachelor's degree yet, and I just couldn't stop college. So I graduated from a little state college in Pennsylvania, Slippery Rock. Slippery Rock, it is now a university. At the time, it was a state college. And then after that, I got married. I was a reporter for a couple of years, and then I married my husband, who was also from Pittsburgh. And he was working out of Salt Lake, so I moved to Utah with him and started my master's program at Brigham Young. I got a master's in English at Brigham Young, and there are a lot of interesting experiences to tell in that one too. But and then I left there on a fellowship to get my PhD at Michigan State, which is another big state college, and that was just an incredible, wonderful, you know, mind-expanding experience too. And so I've just had powerful experiences with education, and I'm so committed to university education and to academic freedom in ways that are almost sacred. You know, I realized with this BYU thing that part of the betrayal of this for me, part of the reason why I'm so angry and why it was so difficult to handle is it wasn't just the priesthood, which, I mean, I'm very used to ineffectual, in fact, malicious priesthood leaders because, you know, in Pittsburgh, you got a warm body with the Melchizedek priesthood. Sometimes he has to be the bishop because he's the only warm body with the Melchizedek priesthood. And so, you know, I had some bad experiences with priesthood holders making mistakes, and I knew that my testimony of the gospel had very little to do with that, but it was difficult when it was general authorities. Anyway, but the other thing that was hard for me to handle is I had thought that the university was really, even though it was against everything I knew about feminist pedagogy, was really this ivory tower where people were open-minded and ideas were free to roam everywhere and people were accepting and we listened to each other and we debated and had healthy, you know, positive kind of contact with ideas and we wrestled them out and we came out friends and we, you know, went off to the faculty club together. I don't know. And it was difficult for me to see that in fact, the university harbors as much prejudice and embarrassing sexism and racism and homophobia as you know, the place, the bar where my dad went after work from the steel mill. They're just a lot more polite about it. So after I graduated from Michigan State, I, as I said, I had some job offers and chose to go to BYU, and that's where I was for 4 years, and now I'm at College of St. Catherine. Yeah. The question is, what about our early education of young women in primary and Sunday school? This is a question very near and dear to my heart because my daughter is 4. And I know all my friends, all my yuppie friends who aren't Mormon, whenever they had children later in life the way I did, you know, I was 31 when my daughter was born, their move back to the church was for their children, you know, to have a place to give their children values and give them what they had. And part of me feels that, you know, I want her to know she's a child of God. I want her to have a relationship with the Savior that, you know, was very important to me, especially in my teenage years that I had. But, oh my goodness, I don't want her to listen to those people over there. The first time I really considered going inactive is when the first time I took my daughter to primary. That's a really difficult question. And I know that a lot of us who choose unorthodox, to make unorthodox choices compared to the ideal Mormon woman, and that's just about all of us, feel like we're kept away from children as much as possible and not used as role models. So I don't know. In fact, it seems to me that the changes in the primary that they've just made are rather positive. Oh, right. Oh, see,
same for nursery and 3 year olds.
See, my impression was just that they were becoming more scripture-centered, more gospel-centered, and less on those silly stories about, you know, how your lie grows and encompasses you and all of that. I'm sorry, too. I wish I had a really nice, positive, upbeat answer to this. In fact, I wish I had positive, upbeat answers to everything. It's painful to have to be angry and upset about these things. And I am. So. Yes? Oh, we hope they can't. He asked me about the appeal process and how BYU can get away with doing things like they did to me and still remain an accredited university. The appeal process is really good on paper. In fact, most of their policies are really good on paper, but they all allow an end run to the general authorities, and they allow the general authorities to end run you. And that's the big glitch that makes academic freedom absolutely impossible at BYU. We've been turned down. I just can't get this mentality out of my head. BYU has been turned down several times by Phi Beta Kappa. They won't establish a Phi Beta Kappa chapter there because of issues about academic freedom, and that's the issue, that that we allow interference in faculty governance from up high, which is against every, you know, belief in how a university should operate. So the appeal process is legitimate on paper, but it doesn't really happen. And what happened in my case was the administrators were told what to do, and then they interfered on the level of faculty governance, on the department level, on the college level, and then on the university committee level with the decisions the faculty made, and in fact told them what decisions to make, or hinted strongly enough that, you know, that's a command in Mormonism, and hinted strongly enough that it was the trustees who wanted these decisions made. It wasn't just Rex. And so, in fact, I have a couple letters that are just appalling in their blatant abuse of that kind of authority, of the general authorities in the process at the point where only faculty should have been involved. So the appeals process was just, they completely broke all of their rules the whole way through. And so in the appeal, I had a really good attorney. We presented all this evidence. Our case was really, really good. In fact, compared to them, even Rex Lee acknowledged at the meeting to my attorney in a little scribbled note, because they were buddies. my attorney wrote, "My expert witnesses beat your expert witnesses, you know, by a mile," or some attorney lingo. And Rex Lee wrote back, "Yes, but mine give us what we need." And all they needed was to pretend they had some sort of case, and it was enough to negotiate on, because we really didn't want to go to court in Utah County against BYU. And but they were afraid enough about going to court in Utah County that they, you know, negotiated. So I'm not sure how they keep their accreditation, and I hope that they get some sort of warning. And it wasn't just my case, of course. It was Dave Knowlton, and it was many cases in their history that were similar, and recently Brian Evanson and his creative work. The embarrassment continues. I mean, I think that they're not doing themselves much good in their image nationally. As good as their football team and their basketball team may be, you also need academic programs to be a university. And it's especially with reference to the humanities, things are getting pretty ugly. So I don't know. I hope maybe they get put on probation by the accreditation committee, which happens this coming year, accreditation. So. Yes?
I wanted to let you know that is issue.
Right. She says that they are talking about the issues with academic freedom and education at BYU in other contexts in her graduate class.
But with reference to your situation.
Yeah, well, I think that the reporting in the Chronicle of Higher Education was pretty much unprecedented. I mean, they really covered it. And people in education read the Chronicle of Higher Education, and it has a lot of effect on how they feel about it. Also, it was in, you know, the New York Times. They followed Levina, and they followed me, and the sorts of things that were happening. I also think that one of the really good things that I'm proud of having done is not go away quietly. Now, I'm a little bit torn about this because they never let me. You know, usually they'll go to a guy who they're having trouble with, put their arm around him and say, "Listen, you know, we are not a very good fit. You know, you are teaching the wrong things about the Book of Mormon or whatever, and maybe you should just go find another job before we fire you. And so people quietly have historically quietly gone away. They never talked to me. They never gave me that chance. I think there might have been a chance had they said, your kind of feminism doesn't work here. If you don't leave, we're going to fire you. I might have maybe, somewhere deep in my heart, wanted to be nice about it, even though I always said, I dare you to fire me. I think the fact that both Dave and I said, you know, we're not going to play this game with you. You have to take responsibility for these kind of behaviors, and we're going to hold you responsible in the public forum. I hope that makes a difference. Yeah.
You're naming, what would those be?
At BYU or at the church in general? Or?
I think in terms of BYU, but
he's asking me two or three things that could change, that could make a difference. I mean, one is what I just talked about today, which is, I think, respecting women's full humanity and our potential divinity. I think that, really, I can't tell you how many times I felt invisible, felt in a situation where people couldn't even see me because having a woman in that situation was so irrelevant to them. Women in certain situations, they can see us and it works for them. So I don't know. I would just encourage all of us to be able to see each other as fully human. And it sounds sort of philosophical, but I think that would make a gigantic difference. For example, at BYU, if you are not a potential stake president or a high council person, you are very likely not in an administrative position. Whether you're a woman or a liberal Mormon or whatever your leaning is, if you don't have that credential, you don't have an office in the Smoot building, unless you're the secretary. And really, BYU is overwhelmingly run by men on the ecclesiastical model. So one easy thing to do would be to get more women in administration. But first, you'd have to respect women enough to get them to teach there. Yeah. Yeah, Brian might be a better person to ask this question to, but I'll attempt from my perspective. He's asking about, you could all hear that, but I guess I need to repeat it into the microphone, about the implied threat that if we don't like the way the church is educating, they don't have to be in the education business and they can quit. I really see that as an extremely remote possibility. For one thing, they'd lose their football team. And, you know, what would we all do? What would we talk about at priesthood meeting? I don't know. So, because if they lose their accreditation, they can't participate in intercollegiate sports. And so it has, you know, other reverberations besides the academic, which to a lot of people don't seem to be very important issues. I think the threat is there. I think they would never carry out that threat. I think they are in the education business, and I think the education business at BYU works really well for them. They're training future church leaders, and they're training them the way they want them to be, in orthodoxy and fundamentalism, and that's their hope, and it works. It's a mill. It's a little factory for church leaders to send them out all over the country and be the kind of leaders they want them to be. And I think they're very interested in maintaining that. I don't think they're very interested in maintaining a high quality, as they say, Harvard of the West major university. And I think that they might lose that opportunity to even, you know, try to attempt that. Yeah. Oh. he's asking me what the future looks like for women scholars at BYU in 10 to 15 years. I know the way that the administrators have talked lately to some of my friends, their threat is, you don't like it here now, you just wait and see how much worse it's going to get. We have changed our direction. We are now doing orthodoxy tests for faculty members. Our students have to graduate from seminary. We care more about whether or not they graduated from seminary than whether or not we're competing with them with the scholarship offer from Stanford. That's not that important anymore. What's important is that we have these orthodox students. And so their attitude about the university has changed. And if they're not bluffing, they're telling the liberal professors, men and women, that that they plan on making it worse, which I don't know how they're going to staff the place, because most people who get educated now get educated in a little more liberal fashion, especially if you get a PhD or something, unless maybe in accounting, which they don't seem to have much trouble with, no offense to all of you accountants out there. But in the business programs, they seem to do okay. In humanities, it's a different thing, you know. That's what we do for a living, is just question everything and make it all look like it's so complicated. And so it's a little more difficult. I don't, you had a comment, Joanna?
Yeah, I was going to say that many of us, you know, a lot of us graduate.
Especially not the best and the brightest. I mean, there are some people who will continue to go there, I'm sure, because we all have, many of us, have a strong commitment to our religion, but they're making it so uninviting that even those of us who are very committed to being Mormon have a hard time teaching there. And as far as women are concerned, there's just no way the attitude about women is going to change there until they start realizing that women are more than just housekeepers for the university, that we can and should be in positions of authority, that we can and should be making decisions about the way the university goes, and that unless we are making those decisions, it's not going to be a welcoming environment for women scholars. And that has not changed at all. I think we've pretty consistently, over the past 20 years or so since Dallin Oaks tried to do better, we've had about two women in the Smoot building, interchangeable, one woman here, one woman there. And they're usually in, like, student life or an office without very much money or authority. In fact, every single committee that reviewed my tenure file, that reviewed my appeal, were all men, except for one committee of about 15 had one woman on it. So, I mean, you just can't maintain that kind of administrative power and expect that women will feel like their voices are being heard and that they matter as scholars. Yes? If my daughter expresses an interest in BYU in about 15 years, what am I going to do? I'm already brainwashing her against that. It won't happen. It's sort of like, I hope they call me on a mission and I love to see the temple. It's BYU stinks. Don't go, don't go. I say it in her ear at night when she goes to sleep.
She's a rebellious teenager.
This scenario all of my friends give me, lace dresses, homemaking, meeting, crocheting, and knitting, this is what they think my daughter's going to turn out to be. I don't think so. It's not in the genes. So I don't know. I mean, I really don't think BYU is a good place to get educated. It might be a really good place to get married, but it's not a good place to get educated, especially not for women. They don't take women students seriously there. In fact, they undermine them. They undermine them academically. It's hard for, I mean, let me just describe to you the difference between my St. Kate students and my BYU students. My students at College of St. Catherine are professionally oriented, they're confident that they have a right to be educated, and they demand the kind of education. I mean, these are women who choose to go to a women's college, so they do have some level of belief in themselves. But they don't ask me if it's okay to make this choice or that choice. They come to me and say, this is what I'm doing, how can you help me? But at BYU, the majority of women I had in my office would say, you know, I'm thinking about going to graduate school. I'm uncomfortable with that because it means I'm acknowledging that I want to be a professional and do this for a living. It means that I'm not going to be a mother, or it means that I have to put off mothering, or I don't know, how do I work this out with being a Mormon and being married? And you know, just the fact of being in that atmosphere, even if you're the most confident woman on earth, it undermines you. It gets to you. And I just don't want my daughter to be part of that. I don't want her to think that she has a disease or something if she's 25 and not married. 25 is my limit. She's not allowed to get married before that. Yeah?
Well, I just make the concept of religion.
But what?
No. I want to be like you.
I think you're right. I think the common thread is the religion, but you're surrounded by it. I mean, it is everywhere. It is pervasive at BYU. You can't get away from it. Whereas if you're a BYU, if you're a Mormon woman at another university, you're surrounded by women with other options, with other choices, and with other attitudes. And those attitudes rub off on you, and you don't feel, at least I didn't feel at my little state college in Pennsylvania, that I was doing something wrong by choosing not to get married until I was finished with college, or chose not to have children until I finished my PhD. That was something all of my friends did. In fact, they wondered why I got married at all. They said, are you sure you want to have children? And at BYU, the assumptions are completely different, and that atmosphere surrounds you so that even if you're very powerful in your sense of yourself, very confident about your choices, it undermines you more, I think, to be a part of that community. Yes? Was there a specific reason for my dismissal officially, and what do I think the reason was? When they first fired me, it was, well, with David Knowlton, they said he only failed in the scholarship category. With me, they just gave it to me. We have three categories on which we're judged: teaching, scholarship, and citizenship. They said I failed in all three, which was quite a stretch considering my academic record and especially my record as a teacher. And the citizenship, I think they, in fact, I expected them to say I failed it on citizenship because to them it meant that I was a Democrat, I was pro-choice, I was a feminist, so I didn't fit in. And that's the reason I was fired because, well, it's... There are lots of reasons, but the person who said to fire me was a general authority who was upset that I gave a public pro-choice speech and said that though I wasn't, I said that I was a Mormon and a BYU professor, but I was representing neither the church nor BYU, that I was speaking as a private citizen, which is all that's required of us as academicians to do when we make public statements. And I gave this very moderate pro-choice speech in which I said, this involves who makes these decisions, and I think women need to make these decisions. I said, I don't like abortion, I'm against abortion, I'm an anti-abortion pro-choice person. Anyway, it's not an unusual position. In fact, most people I know have that position. Most pro-choice people aren't very comfortable with the idea of abortion and want to reduce the number of abortions. Anyway, so for being a very moderate position, it certainly raised a lot of ire from at least one general authority who demanded at that point, at that moment, that I be fired. And the BYU administration said, I'm sorry, we can't do that. We have to go through this process. And then when my speech was reprinted in a journal, in a women's newspaper in Salt Lake City, then they got really mad and said, she's flaunting our authority. She didn't believe we were serious when she said if she kept doing this, she would be fired. But in the meantime, I was asking, could you write this policy down that I'm not allowed to be pro-choice and keep my job? Could you just give that to me in writing? And of course, nobody could give that to me in writing. And then what their charge was is that I was disobedient to the rules. And they wouldn't give me the rule. But it was part of my contract. Anyway, it was all very confusing. But what happened was is they hinted to the faculty that it was their job to get rid of me. And so the faculty committees came through. So in faculty governance, it just so happened that my really good teaching evaluations were proof that I was sort of this charismatic, anti-Christ kind of person undermining the faith of my students. So sure, she has one of the best, you know, teaching records in the English department, but this is what it means. And sure, she has all these publications in scholarly journals that make her more worthy to be promoted than people we've just given tenure to in the English department. But read these articles. They're all really bad. And so, and then the citizenship thing was really easy because, you know, I don't believe in God and I don't believe in Mormonism and, you know, I'm a godless feminist. And that one was a lot easier for them. So, but then after the appeal process, we signed a statement that said, Professor Farr and BYU agree irreconcilably but fundamentally on what constitutes the citizenship requirement of a BYU professor. So we focused down to citizenship. So that was the official reason. Yes?
How do you know that the general authority is behind your firing? Was there a smoking gun letter?
No smoking gun letter. These guys, I don't know if they write them down. Somebody's really good with a shredder, really fast with a shredder. How do I know that a general authority was behind the firing? I heard it from Rex Lee, Bruce Hafen, and Todd Bridge, who are all the top administrators at BYU. They told me the story of why this was happening. They told the story to my husband and my attorney and me, and we took a lot of notes. They didn't name names, but please. I also know who they had to go to approve the settlement, which was, of course, signed by Todd Bridge, the academic vice president, to make it seem like I only settled with the university, but indeed I had settled with the church. The general authority, it had to go through three general authorities' offices before it came back approved. So,
you know
which thing? Uh-huh. I'd rather not. I really want to stay a Mormon for a while.
Well, it was number 6, 7, and 8.
Drum roll, please. That was very nice. Thank you. Yeah. You guys ask hard questions. Okay, how does all of this experience spill over into my own worship and my own relationship with the church? As I said, I've been realizing just lately how very, very angry I am. I mean, I feel betrayed, I feel violated, I feel just very, very angry. And that's a hard emotion for me to live with. It's not something I'm used to having. In fact, I prided myself on having become a feminist and gotten over that angry stage very quickly and gone into the intellectual phase where we're now ready to fix it all. And so now, as I look back, I guess what happened to me, you have to know that in the middle of all this, I had my son. I was, he was 2 months old when I was fired. And when I left, he was a year old. And my needs were kind of secondary at the time, as you women know who have had infants around. It's, you know, you can't say, wait a minute, honey, I'll feed you when I'm done dealing with this anger. So I really didn't deal with it very much while I was there. And since I've gone, I feel I've been writing about it. And as I write about it, I feel it very strongly haunting me. And honestly, I go to church sometimes, and I can't stand to be near anyone in a suit. Because men in suits... At least it's not blue. Because men in suits are who did this to me in my mind. All the way up from the bottom to the top, the only thing they have in common, besides they all have that one appendage of power, is that they all wore suits. And so I have a hard time at church. I love Relief Society. Relief Society is very good for me. In fact, sometimes it's difficult because we say silly things, but in this ward in St. Paul, they've accepted me. They ask me to pray even, which they wouldn't do in Provo for a long time. And they let me serve. I teach the 14 and 15-year-old Sunday school class. And so things, and I still, I have, it's so much a part of who I am that I am Mormon. And my faith is so important to me and has given me, it still does give me direction in my life. And to be like Christ is what it means to me to be Mormon. And being Mormon gives me ways to do that. It gives me opportunities to serve. It gives me people to serve. It gives me challenges. And so I don't have any plans to not be Mormon anymore. But it is very difficult and very, very painful.